All right, it's a download here on WGN. We're past the Ted Cruz and Donald Trump speeches, and we're back to the program. Thanks for sticking with us. Alicia Tate's my guest in studio. She's the director of programs at the Chicago Foundation for Women. We talk about a lot of things tonight. We'll talk about the 100% Project. Talk about your career as a journalist who moved to the public sector and is now with the foundation. And also just about Chicago, because you've covered it from many different angles. Alicia Tate, thanks for being my guest tonight.
Thank you for having me. And I'm glad Donald Trump kept it short so we could get this conversation going.
Alicia, he's still talking. I'm glad you cut out of him
just in a short period of time so we could talk about really important issues for Chicago.
Well, let's talk about the 100% Project, because essentially the mission of this project is to end gender bias by 2030. What does that mean?
Well, it means a bunch of different things. The first thing is we have to recognize what gender bias is. It's one of those things, it's kind of like the air we breathe. It's just around us all the time. There's a really big lack of awareness of what it means. I mean, I think as a city, we're becoming a lot more conscious about race and race, you know, racial inequities and that kind of thing. But gender bias, I don't know, you know, about you, but a lot of women in my generation, we've gotten the message that, you know, the glass ceilings have been broken. We can do anything now. Right. There's no more obstacles. So part of what we have to do first is identify, hey, we all have these biases. We're all expected to play these different roles in society. We get set up to play these roles. And then there are just these deep inequities. I mean, no matter how hard I try, I'm still going to earn 77 you know, cents for every dollar that you earn, no matter what I do. And that's different, even less money for women of color. So that's one piece, is just identifying gender bias. So part of what we've tried to do is get people talking about it more. We kicked off an effort earlier this spring called Talk It Out, which will be an ongoing effort where we just try to encourage people to have those conversations in their workplaces, their homes, their churches, whatever it is, their faith communities. Just talk about what are some of the ways, you know, men and women get treated? Have they ever seen a woman get paid less than a man? You know, just basic questions like that. And when you start telling those stories, and I got to sit in on some sessions with some young people talking about it. When they start talking about the difference between how girls and boys are treated in school, it's really stunning to just...
What are some of those differences? What are you hearing from a different generation?
Like, you hear girls say, well, when I speak up and show my mind as a girl or have opinions as a girl, they tell me I'm talking too much or I'm being too loud or I'm too opinionated. But when the boys act out, they just say, oh, that's just boys being boys.
So that happens all the time. That's a younger generation.
Yeah, that's middle schoolers and high schoolers telling us that. You know, and then there are all kinds of double standards about clothes and how you dress and how you're supposed to conduct yourself, you know, all those kinds of things. One of the most telling comments I heard was from a young woman who said, I fight with my father all the time because he says I'm too opinionated, but my mother raised me to have my own opinions. You know, so she's just caught in the middle.
And I was going to say that seems to be a big, not a problem, but that's an issue in families because you do have the different way that people are being brought up.
Absolutely.
And that seems to have influence in how people act in society.
Absolutely. You know, and so that's one piece, just identifying how this affects all of us in our dynamics, in our lives, in our workplaces. And so we've got try to get people talking about it, but we also recognize this is an issue for everybody. This isn't just a women and girls issue. This affects men and boys too. You guys have a role in this too. It's a setup, you know, the role you guys are expected to play in this. So we've started an initiative to get male champions of change on this issue. CEOs, heads of organizations who say, you know, I'm committed to this issue. This is my issue too. I know that if I'm building organizations and fighting for communities where women and girls have equity, then I'll have a better business. I'll have a healthier community. You know, it just won't work for all of us unless it really works for women and girls too. So that's another part of that. But then we've also got to, you know, collaborate and build partnerships. We recognize we as a foundation can't end gender bias on our own. So we're looking for all kinds of institutions, media, government, corporate sponsors, you know, nonprofits who are also similarly committed to this and who we can work with on different strategies. And then that's kind of the last piece of the puzzle.
Do you find that after
policy changes?
I was going to say, this is an issue that obviously has been around, you know, in modern American, not just American, the global.
Yeah, global.
But it's an issue that I can't see foundations or politicians or businesses or anybody saying, nah, I'm not into that. Like, it just feels to me like that it's the issue that everybody wants to be involved with, yet you still see 77 cents to the dollar.
Well, in principle, I think people agree that it's wrong for there to be this kind of inequity. But we have to actually have policies and strategies to back that up. I mean, we have to have equal pay, and we have to enforce equal pay. You know, we have to have, you know, a dear friend of mine who is a guy who I really consider who really gets it about these issues. He was telling me at his law firm, it's just so interesting that all the partners are men and all the associates are women. You know, that's not okay. You need to have strategies so that that doesn't actually happen, that you create pathways for women to occupy all types of leadership roles.
Right.
And then you have to actually make sure resources are distributed in ways that benefit women and I know and girls. And I know we'll talk about this in a little while, but you know, in terms of the impact of what's happening in the state.
The state of Illinois, yeah.
Those resources are being stripped away. So you can't just do this in principle. We really need everybody to be all in on this effort. We call it like an all-in, all-out effort, you know, where we really have to walk our talk.
Are there
this.
Still, I mean, you've been in some of the, I guess, the professions, I mean, from journalism to politics to even in the foundation work. Are there some areas where you're just not seeing growth or a movement towards equality? Like you mentioned law firms. I mean, are there some areas where it's just always going to be a boys club and they're lagging behind the concept of equal pay or gender, getting rid of gender bias?
Well, I think the growth is slower in most areas than most of us want to admit. I mean, in C-suites in corporate America, the growth is just... it's just barely inching along.
Really?
In terms of women in C-suites and corporates and on corporate boards. I mean, there are a lot of great organizations in Chicago, like the Chicago Network, that work really hard to get more women on boards, get more women in C-suites, but that growth is pretty incremental. And then, you know, and then going down several rungs on the ladder, women are vastly overrepresented among minimum wage workers in Illinois. The vast majority of minimum wage workers in this state are women of color, you know, so... I would call those two areas where we could stand to make a lot of progress. But I think if you look at most organizations, institutions, to really look at, is there parity? Are there really as many women as men in leadership roles? And are they earning the same amount of money? Do they get the same benefits? Do you have policies that actually support women to take those roles? Parental leave, sick time, you know, all the things women need to actually be able to do their jobs well, because we disproportionately, we raise the families, you know, we raise the children. So those are important. So you have to have all those policies. But I think there's room for improvement in pretty much every sector.
Well, let's take a break for the news. But I do want to get at the state budget impasse and how that affects, because it is interesting that if the majority of people working at minimum wage are women of color, that it almost feels like politics is part to play in gender bias as well, because a lot of times it's the people without the voice, the voiceless who, you know, systems and services and social programs are taken away over essentially a political fight. And that continues, and we see it in the state of Illinois. They almost become pawns. And so let's talk. We'll talk about that after the news. Alicia Tate's my guest tonight. She's a director of programs at the Chicago Foundation for Women, former publisher and editor of the Chicago Reporter. Also worked for Lisa Madigan along the way. We'll continue our conversation after the news. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Josh Mogerman's going to be here from the NRDC. Talk about not only securing our waterways and making sure that our drinking water doesn't have stuff in it. We're going to talk about the bomb trains. Chicago Magazine had a big piece about the bomb trains, crude oil, and its transport through the Chicago area. So we'll talk with Josh about that coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also tonight, Jeff Ruby's going to be here, and we're going to interact with you to come up with Chicago Cub nicknames. We need nicknames for the Chicago Cubs. They're going to be a World Series team, the best team baseball's ever seen. Every single player on that team needs to have a legitimate, authenticated nickname. And it comes from WGN Radio. How about that? So we're going to start a new series where we give every single player a nickname. You're the one who's going to help us out, and we have great prizes for you if you give us the winning nickname. That's coming up later tonight on The Download. But right now, we continue our conversation at the big table with Alicia Tate. She is the director of programs at the Chicago Foundation for Women. Alicia, I knew Alicia from when she was the publisher and editor of the Chicago Reporter. How long ago was that now?
Oh, my God. A lifetime ago. No, that was early 2000s. Early 2000s.
Do you miss it? Do you miss being in journalism? Like, I mean, the Chicago Reporter was great because
great
magazines still is. You're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
Doing excellent work.
But really giving voice to the voiceless, talking about some of the stories that are not in the newspapers, doing some really great investigative journalism.
Absolutely.
Do you miss that? Do you miss that part of your life?
I mean, sure, there's things I miss about it. But for me, even journalism, the common theme in my career has always been the issues. I've always just been passionate about issues of equity, you know, on a variety of levels. You know, race and poverty is what we, you know, focused on at the Chicago Reporter. Now I'm, you know, focused on gender bias, but also how it intersects, you know, mm-hmm. with race and economics, too. So as long as I keep getting to work on those issues, I'm happy, you know, really.
Right.
But it was a great place to be. I learned a tremendous amount. Got exposed to so many parts of this city and had a great, great mentor in Laura Washington, who was my predecessor.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah.
Really learned from the best.
You know, you moved on to the public sector. You were a speechwriter and a policy advisor for Lisa Madigan, the Attorney General. I mean, at the Reporter, you did a lot of work, you know, reporting or talking about the issues in government.
Yeah.
Moving to government, what did you learn?
It's very different than reporting on it. I really, having covered government and politics for several years at the Chicago Reporter and, you know, kind of being a local pundit on political issues, I really thought, oh, I know how government works. I know this system. You really do not know it until you are in it.
How so? I'm intrigued.
Well, you know, for one thing, I'll tell you, I had assumed all those times that we had freedom of information requests denied because they said the information is not available in that format. We can't get you that information.
They were hiding something.
They were lying to us. They were just stalling. Once I worked in government, I realized, oh no, they may really not have that information in some logical way that we think it should be kept. Like, it could be in 10 different places. It could be a whole bunch of different people having different pieces of it. It's such a huge, huge, huge system with so many people with their fingers in the pie. Half of what I had to learn in government was just that you have to spend time just figuring out who has what pieces of information.
Right.
So the thing I learned as a reporter that came in handiest when I first started at State of Illinois was the cardinal rule, which is the reporter. You always make friends with the secretaries, every administrative person, because they will know everything and they will help you find everything you can't find.
That's right.
So that was the first thing I did. But no, it was a great experience. The people are incredible because they put up with a lot of stuff. They put up with a lot in terms of just inefficiencies in how government runs, the people walking in off the street with all kinds of issues. We, you know, the Attorney General, people know she has a hotline that actual people answer. So people call with questions about everything, including stuff like their alderman should answer. So people, they're very patient and very kind. And I really loved, you know, what I learned there, but it was definitely a learning experience.
You know, for you, I mean, you mentioned it, but the idea of working at the Reporter and sort of, you know, speaking truth to power and almost, you know, that this power is, or that, you know, the evil empire kind of concept that sometimes we project on the government.
Right.
Does that changed in your life?
I mean,
looking back, you're like now.
Well, when you work for an elected official, of course you have a different perspective on that. You realize these are just people. I mean, they are in particular roles, but they're people. And all the people that I thought, oh, it's those special people making policy and who know, have all the answers and are making decisions, they are just folks. And I really had an appreciation actually for the role of media. Once a good, you know, good journalism, once I was in government, I saw that, you know, politicians and policy folks really do pay attention to really good pieces of media and reporting because government folks do not have the resources to do that kind of
right.
research and in-depth, you know, kind of examination of issues. So that was also a good learning.
So investigative reporting is it's
really,
they're
valuable.
Paying attention to
hugely,
it.
Hugely valuable. And the other thing to tie it to my current job, you know, working for Lisa Madigan in particular was, you know, getting to work for a woman who's been very, very intentional about building a team with a lot of women in key leadership roles. That was a new experience for me there. And I think made a big difference in terms of just my own kind of leadership development, my own growth. That was different from anything I had experienced in my career, being around that many women sort of making those calls, you know, in big ways.
See, you didn't see that in other governmental agencies, sort of a push to have more women involved in their offices?
You know, I don't want to comment on what other officials do, but I definitely think, you know, Attorney General Madigan is known for that, for being very intentional about that. And it does make a difference when a woman is the boss. I mean, it just really does. We make that case with race all the time. You know, we know, like, you know, talk about the Academy Awards or whatever. Well, sure. We need more Black people producing movies. You know, we need more Black people in the Academy. It's the same with women. When you have women in charge, more women get chances and opportunities that they normally wouldn't get.
Let's talk about the state government impasse. We kind of teased this out at the beginning of the, before we went to the news. But, you know, I'm fascinated to think about, I mean, really kind of, I'm curious, I guess, to the idea that this is disproportionately affecting women. The idea of services, social yep. programs, yep. things that are being cut because the governor and the Speaker of the House are standing their ground.
Yeah, well, let me give you a few examples of this. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that low-wage workers are disproportionately women. So when you strip away safety nets, they are going to be the most affected. The households that depend on the state's child care subsidies, we've heard a lot in the news about the child care mm-hmm. subsidies. 78% of those households are female-headed households. You know, those are single moms who depend on that subsidy. More than half of the students in Illinois' public universities are women. You know, women make up the majority of students who receive those MAP grants that we've heard so much about. And just in terms of what's happening in the nonprofit sector in general, 7 out of 10 nonprofit workers in Illinois are women.
Hmm.
And those agencies, as we know, are being like dramatically affected yeah. by this. The United.
So when we talk about social service cuts,
yes,
it disproportionately affects women.
It disproportionately affects women. The United Way has been surveying the organizations it provides funds to, and earlier this year, you know, it found that over a quarter of those organizations had been laying off staff already. So then women lose their jobs. So all of these things eat away at women's ability to be self-sufficient. And I'll give you a couple of very specific examples from our grantees. One is an agency called Family Shelter Services, which is out in DuPage County in Wheaton, you know, an area that we consider pretty affluent. And yet issues of domestic violence happen everywhere. So they were working with a woman who was trying to leave her abuser. She has a child, you know, she's trying to leave her abuser. They helped her find a job. They helped her find an apartment. And she was able to move out. But then she lost her child care subsidy from the state. So she had to move back in with her abuser. She just did, without that support, she cannot be economically right. self-sufficient and support her child. That's one example. Another agency that we funded is the Pediatric AIDS Chicago Prevention Initiative. And this is, you know, there's been a lot of publicity about this initiative. This initiative has prevented the transmission of HIV from mothers to babies, mm-hmm. and it saves the state $35 million a year. That program is going to end in November unless there's a budget, because 90% of its funding comes from the state. It costs us an average of $1 million over a lifetime, you know, to support a baby who's been born HIV positive.
Do politicians, especially the ones in leadership positions, Are they familiar with these demographic breakdowns? Do you think that they understand who they're directly or disproportionately affecting when there is inaction like there is?
I think, of course, that depends on the politician, Justin. And I think that, you know, people really underestimate the importance of you communicating to your local elected officials what a difference this is making in your community, what damage this is doing to your community. Because we also know that whole communities suffer when women suffer. Women are like the backbone of most communities, particularly communities that are most impoverished. So they have got to hear from us that this is affecting all different aspects of the community. And I found it, you know, kind of encouraging, just to give a little shout out. You know, we had a number of women elected to the General Assembly in this mm-hmm. last election cycle, women with social justice backgrounds, you know, who are not career politicians, who bring some fresh voices, perspectives, women of color, you know. So I'm optimistic that we'll have a little bit more responsiveness to this. But I think people just really have to communicate this over and over and over again.
My guest tonight at the big table, Alicia Tate. She's the director of programs at the Chicago Foundation for Women. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up the conversation. I want to get your take on Chicago. Obviously, you know, you've seen it from a lot of different angles.
There's a lot going on in Chicago.
We'll talk about your take on the city in which you live when we come back here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest at the big table tonight, Alicia Tate, longtime journalist who was a publisher and editor of the Chicago Reporter here in town. She worked for Lisa Madigan as a speechwriter and a policy advisor, and now she's the director of programs at the Chicago Foundation for Women. You've seen Chicago from a lot of different angles. I mean, I have to ask, because when you were, like you said, the Chicago Reporter in the early 2000s, I mean, and they still do it today, there is a focus on race and poverty.
Yes, absolutely.
Working in the government, there's I would assume you've done a lot of policy advising on race and poverty. And even with as we're talking about here with your role with the Foundation for Women, you know, race and poverty play a role.
So
talk about what you've seen change and evolve over the last 26 years.
Well, you know, I was talking with some friends about this a while ago, and I remember when I first started at the Chicago Reporter in 98, and we still had to kind of make the argument that, like, race matters. Race is something you should pay attention to. Race is important. I don't think we have to make that argument the same way anymore.
Right.
Which is, you know, for better or worse, I think you'd have to be living under a rock to not think that race is an issue in Chicago. It's so visible. It's so open. It's just so out there and obvious that a lot more people are paying attention to it. I don't think they know what to do about it. And I think that the incredible level of organizing and activism that's happening, particularly among millennials, particularly among, like, black millennials, Latino and immigrant young people, the dreamers, you know, all of that activism that's happened in the last few years. I don't think a lot of us, you know, older head civic types know what to do about all that, but it's a level of energy and change happening in Chicago that I have not seen in 25 years.
The Black Lives Matter movement here is led, I mean, some of the prominent leaders of that movement are black women.
Black women, and they are black queer women. And that's a very important part of their politics. And they make that very much known. And that means that they sometimes clash with the more established, you know, black leadership in the city. It's really interesting to see the generational divides and tensions and how that'll play out. I don't know. But I think it is inspiring, and it is not coincidence that so many of these different pieces. See, Black Lives Matter. People say Black Lives Matter. It's not just one organization. I mean, there is an organization called Black Lives Matter with chapters all over the country. But there are many organizations working on these issues. BYP 100, Asada's Daughters, any number of We Charge Genocide, all kinds of organizations, many others that I didn't mention. Working in coalition on all kinds of different aspects of this, you know, criminal justice reform. And what I find really interesting is they've used the election so much as community organizing tools, as we saw in the Cook County State's Attorney's race, which is really interesting. But now they're really shifting. A lot of the work is around really redistributing resources into communities, you know, that there's a really sophisticated analysis of where are our dollars and our resources going in this town, and are those the right places for them to go? You know, and they really are demanding a whole kind of different investment in communities that have been underserved, you know, historically in Chicago. I have not seen that before.
Yeah, and it's interesting,
it's
too,
very
because
inspiring.
Obviously jobs are at a premium in some of the in minority communities, the African American community especially. I mean, the number of jobs has diminished to a point. I see some staggering quotes that you'll hear and stuff, 40, 50, 60% unemployed.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
terrible.
And you wonder how that plays into, obviously, how poverty plays into some of the other social issues that are grabbing headlines.
Yeah.
But it always comes back to the fact that there is an economic opportunity for some people in this city.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to tie it into what we've been talking about, I mean, for us as an organization at Chicago Foundation for Women, to create this project around ending gender equity, we went and had conversations with hundreds of people around the city. And across all of the spectrums, everyone said women's economic security had to be the key issue. That making sure women have sustainable economic, you know, have wages and supports to just support their families, you know, live a productive life. That is the key issue, because you can't, you know, all these things. You want people to get civically engaged. You want them to be good citizens. Right. You want them, you know, to do all this stuff. They can't do that if they are worrying about putting food on the table. They cannot be good citizens if they don't know how they're going to feed their children, or if they're making decisions between paying a medical bill or buying, you know, clothes, a school uniform for their child. So we have to make sure those basic supports are in place. And so that's why I do think it is very exciting that more different kinds of groups are coming together around the economic issues. And even though it's not the circumstances we would have hoped for, I think the state budget is also prompting a lot of that work. The Responsible Budget Coalition is, I think it's up to almost 300 different organizations now, a range of organizations that are trying to figure out all kinds of solutions, fiscal solutions, financial solutions, to preserve that economic security for vulnerable populations.
Maybe, I mean, in a weird way, maybe the budget impasse is bringing more people to the table civically to figure out how they're going to, you know, work with this economy moving forward than they would have done if politicians just snapped their fingers and put phantom budgets in, as they have done.
Well, I think people are making lemonade out of lemons, for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Alicia Tate, former publisher and editor of the Chicago Reporter, now the director of programs at the Chicago Foundation for Women. She's my guest tonight at the big table. Alicia, great to have you on the show. Thanks for being here.
Really enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Justin.